Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, it's not just Friday on the Brian Lehrer Show. It is follow-up Friday when we try and answer some of the burning questions that came up and got left hanging during the week. And let's start with something that came up during a segment we did on the usefulness of the Internet. Here is Lee Siegel, author of Against the Machine, Being Human in the Age of the Electronic Mob.
And in fact, there was a front-page article in the New York Times last week which illustrates this point. It was about how bloggers are under such pressure to blog 24/7 that some of them are actually dropping dead at their keyboards. And in my book, I talk about how the web is really turning all our leisure time into work.
Who has dropped dead at their computers?
There were two prominent bloggers. I've forgotten their names, alas. But they died, alas, because they were blogging so heavily. And
bloggers dropping dead? Alas, well, let's follow up on that. Joining me now is Timothy Noah, senior writer at Slate.com, and he wrote a piece this week about death by blogging. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
Did this really happen, and where did Lee Siegel get this idea that bloggers are dropping dead?
The New York Times ran a story on April 6th that was headlined, In Web World of 24/7 Stress, Writers Blog Till They Drop. This story was completely made up, and I was able to establish that by using the investigative technique I call reading all the way to the end of the story.
That's quite innovative. So what do you mean completely made up?
There was no evidence whatsoever for this proposition. They came up with apparently two bloggers died. Yes, they died. You take any large group of people and you will be able to find two of them who died. There's no information in the story that suggests that either of them died for reasons having anything to do with their occupation.
Symptoms were listed in the article, as I get it, as sleep disorders, exhaustion, and heads I win, tails you lose, weight loss or gain. The number affected was, quote, unclear, but, quote, surely several thousand and maybe even tens of thousands. So what does that mean? These are conditions roughly associated with blogging a lot?
These are conditions roughly associated with any number of things. And incidentally, these were not the symptoms of the people who died. We don't find out anything about the symptoms of the people who died. One of the people who died, we find out where he was when he died. He was not at his keyboard. He was he had actually left his house to cover a convention 3,000 miles away. And the other person, we don't find out a single fact about the circumstances of their death.
So I see another article for the New York Times. Flyer who travels 3,000 miles dies. But the tone of that piece was definitely tongue-in-cheek, and it started some buzz. So I think maybe people didn't read it the right way.
Well, look, yes, of course, we all should get out and get some exercise now and then. And yes, I'm sure blogging can be a stressful occupation. It is far from the only stressful occupation. And let's keep this all in perspective. I did what the reporter for the New York Times should have done, which is go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics list of the country's most dangerous jobs. Guess what? The jobs that are going to kill you are the ones that are likeliest to give you lots of fresh air and exercise.
Like?
Fisherman is number one. Pilot is number two. Logger is number three. Iron worker or steel worker is number four. Garbage collector, farmer, power lineman, roofer, driver, and agriculture worker. Those are the top ones. Information industry worker is way, way down there. It doesn't even rank especially high among other white-collar jobs.
Fisherman was number one, huh?
Fisherman is number one.
I fought the trout, and the trout won.
All that bracing sea air is not likely to lengthen your life.
Timothy Noah, senior writer at Slate.com. I'm glad you're still alive. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Before we move on to other follow-ups, I want to play one more clip from that Lee Siegel interview. Here's a question I asked him on Wednesday, but I want to take you one step further, because Wikipedia seems to epitomize for you everything that's wrong with the internet. In full disclosure, I love Wikipedia. But in your words, it's created and edited by anonymous people who are free to misrepresent historical facts and malign living people. Why?
Well, I don't know why you love Wikipedia. That sounds to me like an abusive relationship. Because Wikipedia, it's shifting mounds of trivia and gossip and, in some cases, slander.
Well, and we're back live. I have to admit that after we did that segment, my relationship with Wikipedia did become a little more abusive. One of those shifting mounds of trivia and gossip found its way onto the Brian Lehrer entry. At 2:28 p.m. on Wednesday, someone went and edited my Wikipedia page to state that I live in New York with my wife and 37 sons. Now, of course, I don't know who this was. We did trace the IP address and found out they were here in Manhattan, but perhaps this proves Lee Siegel's point. Touche. But wait, lo and behold, my faith in Wikipedia has been restored. As a mere 2 hours later, some other person came in and corrected that misinformation to 36 sons. Anyway, let's move on to another item for Follow-Up Friday. During a segment we did on the Olympics and China, we were asking callers whether or not President Bush should boycott the opening ceremonies of this summer's games. And we took a call from John in Manhattan.
Brian, how are you?
Okay.
One thing that I've been hearing on other shows is it would actually be a precedent for the U.S. president to attend the opening ceremonies. No U.S. president has ever attended an opening ceremonies of the Olympics.
Oh, that's really interesting. So, well, you know what? We have a China expert guest coming up in just a minute after you, so we're going to try to confirm that fact. And alas, our China expert didn't know, but we've been furiously researching this tidbit ever since, and here's what we found. As it turns out, Laura Bush was at the 2006 opening ceremonies in Turin, Italy, and George H.W. Bush, the 41st president, was at the 2004 Games in Athens. So maybe there's something to this. Maybe presidents do skip opening ceremonies, but at least one, the dad of the current president, was there. But wait, just when you think you're at the end of your research options, good old YouTube comes to the rescue.
On behalf of a proud, determined, and grateful nation, I declare open the Games of Salt Lake City, celebrating the Olympic Winter Games.
Yes, W, opening the 2002 Salt Lake City Games. And there's more on YouTube.
I declare open the Games of Atlanta, celebrating the 26th Olympiad of the modern era.
Bill Clinton at the opening ceremony of the 1996 Summer Games in Atlanta. So, John in Manhattan, not sure what other shows you were referring to there, but I'm glad we could straighten that out. Though, to be fair, we've yet to find evidence that a sitting U.S. president has attended the Olympics in another country. We'll call it a draw. One more item to follow up on. Yesterday on the show, we had a completely unprecedented moment for the Brian Lehrer Show. This was during the NAP Strategies segment. Let's take a listen.
I go to Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, and one of the things the college is known for, the reason we're all paying tons of money to go there, is that, I'm being pulled over by the police.
Oh, no. Well, you better go. Goodbye. Yes, that was Lily calling on her cell phone and apparently getting stopped for who knows what, but all of us in the studio were worried sick about her. Luckily, she called back a few minutes later. Oh, Lily,
hey.
Lily is back. Lily, the police pulls you over for what?
The craziest thing just happened to me. I was walking downtown in Bronxville, and I crossed the street to go to a coffee shop, and I guess I was jaywalking, and the cop was like, hey, did you know you were jaywalking? And I was like, sorry. I was on the phone with a guy doing a radio show, and he was like, oh, well, call him back. You know, don't jaywalk again.
You got out of your ticket by telling him you called the Brian Lehrer Show?
I did. I told him I called your show, and he's like, all right, well, you know, free pass for you then.
So we're glad Lily got out of that ticket because of us. But it got me thinking, when was the last time someone actually got pulled over for jaywalking? And what exactly is so wrong with jaywalking if you think you can make it? Well, to help answer that question, we're going to check in with Peter Norton, a professor at the University of Virginia and the author of Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. Peter, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
So the obvious question, why is it called jaywalking?
Well, you'll see a lot of people giving you a lot of theories about it, but I've looked into it, and it comes from a Midwestern expression about 100 years old. A jay was somebody who was not sophisticated with city ways, didn't know how to get around in the city. It's a slur against rural folk coming into town and getting dazzled by the sights and the show windows and so on.
Huh, so jay is like hick.
Exactly.
Bumpkin. So the fact that people who are unfamiliar with cars were called jays signals a pretty big paradigm shift in terms of how we think of our streets.
Yeah, and the way it turns out, actually, is that the term jaywalking, unlike jay, which was sort of a naturally evolved word like any other, the word jaywalking was actually an invention designed to help redefine what streets are for, because when the word was first used, pedestrians thought of streets as places for them.
Shocking concept.
Right, and to give cars legitimacy in streets, this definition had to be changed, and streets had to be defined as places for cars, and therefore not for pedestrians. And so this word got promoted by auto clubs and auto dealers in cities about 80 to 90 years ago, and the promotional tactics were really quite inventive. They had people dressed up as clowns that with signs on them that would say, "I'm a jaywalker," and these people would attract attention by crossing streets dangerously. They even got Boy Scouts, free child labor, really, to hand out little cards that said, "Did you know you were jaywalking?" And the fact is, people didn't know. They'd never heard of the word, but this is how the word got circulated, so that it actually entered a dictionary for the first time in 1924.
Huh. All in the pursuit of giving cars priority over pedestrians on our streets, it sounds like. So jaywalking today could almost be seen as a form of civil disobedience.
Sure. I mean, the fact is, jaywalking is not like a natural concept like gravity or photosynthesis or something like that. It's a creation. It's an idea that was deliberately thought up to redefine streets.
So we have 20 seconds left. What about our caller who got pulled over? Do you have any idea of how common that is to actually get nabbed anywhere in America? This
is
Bronxville.
It's happening every day, and sometimes the results are pretty extraordinary. For example, a lot of people who come to the United States are not familiar with this concept of jaywalking. I'll just give you one recent example. January 2007, a world-renowned historian, British historian named Felipe Fernandez Armesto, was pulled over in Atlanta and pinned to the ground by six cops, and it was put on the front page with a full-page picture of the arrest on the London Standard with the headline,
wow,
"London Historian Held by Gun Cops for Jaywalking."
Well, at least they didn't tase him. Peter Norton from the University of Virginia, written on jaywalking before, his book Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And now our final follow-up item. We've been doing our NAP Strategies project over the past week, where we asked you to sneak a bit more shut-eye into your workday. Well, let's put that project to bed. Here are our Brian Lehrer Show NAP tips, courtesy of producer Kate Hines. Cue the music. One, familiarize yourself with your employee handbook. We noticed that hours mentioned sleeping on the job might be cause for dismissal. Thumb through yours, okay? Two, don't be a germophobe. Many listeners wrote in praising the virtues of what one commenter called the dreaded toilet nap. Use the toilet paper as a pillow, lock the door, and benefit from the fact that all things bathroom-related constitute a don't ask, don't tell zone in the workplace. Three, love your cube. If your back is to everyone else, try what one listener does. Said, I just put my hand lightly on the mouse and closed my eyes. It has taken a few years of practice to prevent my head from falling over, but I think I have mastered that part. If you're not quite there, one listener uses the head leaning on the hand technique at his cube. Several of you pull a George Costanza and sleep under your desk. Four, use your commute, but carefully. Sleeping on the bus, subway, train is a time-honored tradition, but as one person warned, I once awoke on a bus with my shoelaces tied together. You never know who's around to take advantage. And no, you Shouldn't Sleep While Driving, Rick from Middletown. And finally, Don't Go Too Far. One listener, a stage manager, fell asleep on a catwalk, only to be awoken by a stage light shining in her face at the opening of Act One. Those are our nap strategy final tips, courtesy of producer Kate Hines, and that's Follow Up Friday for this week.